Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research, development, and innovation. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs over the past 10 years at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is proud to acknowledge the underwriting support of our friend Mr. Steve Brockman. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by Steve for the advancement of science and education. It's also a great pleasure to acknowledge the underwriting support of Dr. Bob Conder of Carolina Neuropsychological Service of Raleigh and Chapel Hill. Bob provides neurocognitive evaluations and neurofeedback for sports concussions and optimal sports performance. You can learn more about Carolina Neuropsychological Service at carolinacns.com. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by Chapel Hill Eye Care, located at 235 South Elliott Road in Chapel Hill. Chapel Hill Eye Care provides comprehensive eye care to people of all ages. Healthy eyes for a lifetime. Chapel Hill Eye Care, 919-968-4774. And last but not least, Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the Triangle Center for Evolutionary Medicine, or TRISEM, a nonprofit center exploring the intersection of evolutionary science and medicine. TRISEM is jointly operated by Duke University, the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, North Carolina State University, and North Carolina Central University. TRISEM is an incubator that promotes innovative developments in the theory and practice of evolutionary medicine by fostering cross-disciplinary collaborations among triangle-based scholars, physicians, public health workers, and more. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. This week, we bring you a special edition of Radio In Vivo. On April 13th, we were treated to a very informative panel discussion called Science on the Campaign Trail, held at the Frontier in Research Triangle Park. The event was co-sponsored by the North Carolina Newsroom Cooperative and Science Communicators of North Carolina and was part of the North Carolina Science Festival. Moderator Susan King, Dean of the UNC School of Media and Journalism, introduced the panelists and asked them to begin with brief comments about their activities.
Oh, I'm going to start with Bill Adair, because he's from Duke. And it's proof that we guys who hate each other in the basketball court really do like each other when it comes to the intellectual life of the triangle. So Bill and I have bonded here. He is a Knight professor, Carnegie Knight. He's the Knight side of it. And Knight has invested fantastic professors at some of the great universities, and you're so lucky to have that chair because it is great, isn't it? He's the professor of journalism and public policy, and he's really a pioneer in accountability journalism. He worked in Washington for a long time, and he created PolitiFact, which many of you probably turned to during the political year, and it's a Pulitzer Prize winning website. But you may also know the way a journalist writes it. It's not the way a professor always writes it, you know. He calls it truth-o-meter or pants on fire. That's the rating. Because that's the way a journalist writes pants on fire. So tell us a little bit about this sort of why you got in the business of checking facts, journalism, and how is it really gaining some steam? I even understand international people are thinking of.
So I got into fact-checking for the very reason that you mentioned, which is my belief that there was too much on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism. And I have been covering the White House in 2004, 2005, and I felt guilty, like we were passing along falsehoods without checking them because there was this expectation that, as you said, journalists would just tell both sides and they had done their duty. And so in 2007, we started PolitiFact as a way of fact-checking the candidates in the 2008 campaign. And now PolitiFact has grown to 17 state sites, including our newest site, North Carolina, which just started about 3 weeks ago, done by the great talented staff at the News Observer. And if you want to know the facts about HB2, PolitiFact North Carolina has done some great fact-checking on HB2. And it is not, on the one hand, on the other hand, journalism. It is journalism, I call it reported conclusion journalism. So this is where the journalist goes out and does thorough reporting, just like he or she would for any story, and then reaches a conclusion and rates the statement on the truth of meter. And then finally, to answer your question about the growth, so now that I'm at Duke, I continue to be involved with PolitiFact, but at Duke, I run our journalism program in the DeWitt Wallace Center, and we focus a lot on following fact-checking around the world, doing research into the growth of fact-checking. And we were amazed, my colleague Mark Stenzel is here, who manages, where are you, Mark Stenzel? Way in the back, Mark tracks the fact-checking sites around the world, and we published our annual census of fact-checking and found that there has been growth of 50% in fact-checking around the world. So there are more than 100 websites around the world that are doing political fact-checking, and in some unlikely places, in places like Iran and Nepal and Russia. So it's a great movement. I'm thrilled to see it, and it's great to be here talking about it.
Fantastic. I've got about five follow-up questions to that, but I'm going to introduce our next person, Doug, and we're going to bring you into the conversation. I'm going to just have to start here because we're going to get into. So Eugene Colley is a veteran newspaper journalist as well, a director of factcheck.org, which is at the Annenberg Club of Policy at a school at the University of Pennsylvania. It's been around for a long time and something that has ultimate respect, and respect comes right with your name. And it really has always looked at the falsehoods in political discourse that's kind of tried to find that. Last year, decided to get into the science business, so it started SciCheck because of false and misleading information in the science world. So I always found on the debate, you just go to the other person who, when you were trying to get both sides of the story, they just said bad science, and they tried to answer every question. So you decided that you had to start SciFact because science was so bad, the facts were hard to come into.
We're
just manipulating the evidence, what?
All of the above. we started SciCheck. Well, first of all, just back up for a second, factcheck.org, similar to PolitiFact. What we do is fact-check political statements by candidates, the president, all major elected officials. So, and we've been around since 2003. Last year, we got some funding to start SciCheck. So we have a person who has, who's a science writer, who has a degree, advanced degree in science, who is a freelance science writer. So this person brings to factcheck.org a level of expertise that we didn't have. And that was one of the, it was a gap that was missing in our coverage. We have good coverage on healthcare, we have good coverage on finance, on politics, but science is a different creature and it required to have somebody with some expertise. So we started that a year ago. It's been it's been a huge success. It's fantastic. We fact-checked 12 of the presidential candidates so far on various issues, anything from mostly climate change, because a lot about climate change for sure, But there's also GMOs and Zika we've written about. A lot of these public policy issues that are very complicated, very confusing, the public doesn't have a lot of knowledge about it, and politicians sometimes don't have a lot of knowledge about it. But what knowledge they do have, they will try to misrepresent and distort in order to advance their political agenda. So what we do is call them on it. So when there's any statements that are made through the course of debates, TV interviews, rallies and speeches that they give that we see are misleading, we'll write them up.
Okay, we're going to get to what that means in a second. So I'm going to introduce Laura Leslie, who you all, I'm sure, know well, WRNL in Raleigh. I've become a fan of her. She makes women reporters on TV look good.
Thank you.
So pleased of that.
From you.
You know, smart women I love to see on TV. And that's Laura. And she covers, of course, the Capitol and government and political news, which, as a newcomer to North Carolina, was really important for me to understand. And so that's how I got to really know your work. She has been president of the National Statehouse Journalists for the Capitol Beat. And science is not something that intimidates her, despite the fact that she's mostly covered politics, because you actually, when you were at radio, National Public Radio, you did a Moment of Science show. So tell us right now, closer to home, I sometimes hear that legislation has been passed that there is no sea rise going. So how is it covering science and politics?
Well, you know, I think bending science facts is a bipartisan pastime for her. You know, it is. But our current crop has really lifted it to the next level. And the sea level rise, I'm assuming a lot of you are from around here, you've probably heard about that one. One that kind of is close to home for me is, do any of you do fish tanks? Aquariums, any of you aquarium keepers? Okay. As many people know, I'm a fish tank person. I have like four saltwater tanks and a freshwater tank and whatever. And so normally it's like a second job that you pay to have, right? But normally it doesn't overlap much with my job as a political reporter until 2013 when we started talking about algae. Algae is something I know a lot about, right? I mean, every single day. It's also something we talked a lot about in terms of Jordan Lake. As a lot of you know, Jordan Lake was created as a reservoir, a drinking water reservoir for this area, RTP, and Cary and Western Raleigh. And everybody knew from the get-go it was going to be what they call an impaired body, right? Which is its own joke, but we'll just leave it at that. It's going to have trouble, simply put, because all the nutrients and all the pollution were going to run from all the watershed north of the lake, into the lake, and there's no outflow, right? So the lake was just going to get more and more nutrient-rich. And of course, when you have that, you have algae. So in 2009, State Long Range passed a set of rules called the Jordan Lake Rules. And the idea was that all these municipalities upstream were going to need to improve the way that they treated their wastewater. They're going to need to increase the setbacks on property to try to prevent runoff from, and also agricultural runoff, you know, from fertilizer used in the fields. And so this was going to help reduce the nutrient load and reduce the algae problem. Well, pretty soon they figured out that it was getting expensive to do that. And so in 2013, somebody came up, and we don't know who, because it was slipped into the budget last minute behind closed doors, and nobody will own this, right? Water mixers called solar bees. They are these giant, I'm not kidding, there are these giant water mixers with solar panels that power them, and somebody decided that the answer to the problem in Jordan Lake was not to have nutrient reduction of the road, it was just to stir the water around a lot, and somehow that was going to prevent algae. They bought that. You bought that. $1.3 million, right? In 2013, you paid another $1.5 million for it in 2015. It's not doing anything. As anybody with a fish tank knows, you can't stir nutrients out of water, right? You gotta stir it, you gotta keep it water moving, but that's necessary, but it's not sufficient. It's like saying, if I shake this milkshake, half the calories will fall out, right? So, but it's okay. Your lawmakers were not bothered by scientific fact in this case because, of course, the lure of money, because the folks upstream, the developers, the real estate folks, the home builders, city officials, county officials, anybody who didn't want to have to pay to reduce the nutrients said, that sounds like a winner. Let's go with the mixers and never mind these silly rules that none of us want to follow anyway. So out, sorry, long story, but to sort of put a postscript on it, we're still talking about this. They put 36 of those things in Jordan Lake. Several of them drifted off and were found wrecked in tributaries. They did a 2-year study on this, and they finally published it. It was supposed to be out last October, and then it was supposed to be out April 1st. Well, they put the draft report on the DEQ website, Department of Environmental Quality, and the draft report said, aha, guess what? It doesn't work, right? Because it's never worked in any other lake in America either, but apparently ours was going to be special. So anyway, so then that draft report suddenly disappeared from the website. And DEQ said, oh, we're not finished with it. We're going to have to make some changes to it before we're ready to talk about it. So, and that has been a trend with this administration, the governance we have right now, is if you don't like the facts, send them back. It's like they're an overdone steak or something, right? They pulled reports on riparian buffers. They pulled reports on solar bees. They pulled reports on charter school performance. Send them back to have them made more politically palatable. So that's the kind of stuff that makes me crazy. Almost as crazy as Algie.
So we'll take more than facts. So that's a perfect segue almost to me, don't you think? Cheryl Kirschenbaum started something called the Energy Poll at UT Austin, and it was really focused on expanding public understanding of science and energy. But she also runs something called Science Debate, where you're trying to get really a presidential level discussion and really focus on science. So I want to know how you're doing on that. But she's also, I'm calling her the science geek here, because I'm thinking the rest of us sort of in the political world, she's our science geek, because she really does know what she's talking about. She's written a book, co-authored Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. And she also wrote a no doubt less depressing book called Science of Kissing. So we want to know, how is it going to kind of promote this in this kind of crazy building of the year? Are people willing to really debate in a serious way?
That's a good question, right? And I just have to say, you know, my background's in science, and then I came into writing much later. So just as an aside, I went to graduate school in ocean science, and I used to work at Duke on ocean policy. And so I'm just thinking, they had a lot of people, a lot of experts they could have come to and said, does nutrients work? And they probably would have said, no. Could have saved a lot of money there. ScienceDebate.org. So what we do is we are pushing for a presidential debate on science policy. We don't want to quiz all the candidates on what they remember from high school science. We want to know simply what policies might look like if these individuals are elected to office. And we don't think it's a huge ask. I mean, a lot of the times we hear, well, I can't talk about climate change, or I can't talk about genetically modified organisms because I'm not a scientist. But they talk about the economy, and they're not economists. And they talk about foreign policy, and they're not diplomats. And so we don't think it's so much of a stretch to expect that they're going to address issues that are going to fundamentally influence and impact the way we live for decades to come, not just with our generation, but our children and their children. And unfortunately, a lot of the time, policies are discussed on a 4-year timeline. And the science issues, and I used to work on the Hill, a lot of the time you're in that space, the science gets relegated to the back or treated as a special interest. And that's simply unacceptable. So Science Debate believes that addressing science on the campaign trail should be the expectation rather than the exception. So what we do is we crowdsource questions. Anyone can visit our website at sciencedebate.org and submit a question on a range of issues. A lot of people assume we're all about climate change, and we are interested in climate change, but there are so many more. Mental health is really important. We aren't hearing enough about that. Genetically modified organisms, Zika, I mean, and on and on and on. So we crowdsource questions. We wind up with so many thousands each cycle. And we work with leading individuals and groups like the National Academies, groups like the American Association for the Advancement of Science, to get this list down to a manageable size. We began in 2007, so we were active in the 2008 election and the 2012 election. And while you haven't seen a live televised science debate yet, because you'd all know if there had been one, we We have submitted a series of questions, 14 questions each cycle, to the final candidates. So far, President Obama twice, Senator McCain, and Governor Romney have all responded to every question in writing. So at least they can be held to what they said their policies might look like if elected. And then we don't weigh in, so we leave it to the folks who do the fact-checking to kind of give a sense of how realistic some of these policies might be. And that's my story.
Fantastic. Now, this is fantastic to see the kind of variety of things and the perspectives that we put in. So I want to start right away. People would say, you're biased, Bill. Where's your money come from? Your idea of a fact is just a biased position. That's not fact.
You know, when people say that, and we hear that a fair amount, I think of, we see bias when we have deep passions. And so if you're a strong Republican, if you're a strong Democrat, you may be reluctant to accept a fact check when your candidate is called out for a falsehood. Now, I can understand those passions because I know about the refs in the ACC, and I know how biased they are against Duke. And so I totally relate to that. And this question of bias is something, and you know, Eugene can speak to it too, we face all the time. It's a really convenient complaint. And what I try to challenge people to do is say, give me the specifics. What specifically in our fact check is wrong, or what conclusion do you disagree with? And I think this is something that we all need to do to combat this concept of, well, the media is biased. It's such an easy complaint, except for the rest of the ACC, that I think we need to push back on it and say, no, you know, we're, you know, show us the specifics. And there are plenty of times, you know, when we get some things wrong and we correct them. I mean, I say plenty of times, fortunately that's a small percentage of all the fact checks that we do, but I think it is important to push back. Do you agree with that?
No, absolutely. Just before I came here, I'll answer every email that I get on bias, and I get my back up about it, because it is just a convenient way of pushing back on what is fact. I mean, our site, as Bill's is fact-based. So just before I came here, I responded to a Bernie Sanders supporter who said that we support Hillary Clinton, and a Hillary Clinton supporter who said, why do you hate Hillary? So, and I probably should have introduced them to each other. And, you know, I'll give them a little summary of, okay, well, here's what we've done on Hillary Clinton, here's what we've done on Bernie Sanders, and we're going to continue doing these kinds of things on both of these candidates and all of the candidates. So you just have to educate them, really, as to what it is we do, how we do it, why we do it, and try to explain to them that there is no bias behind the facts.
But what about the money? Because people always look at the money. You have to raise money. So they might look at the money folks and say, oh, you have money from these liberals. Or conservatives, or whatever. So.
Well, we get our funding from the Annenberg Foundation, primarily. They have a founding grant that has kept FactCheck.org going for a long time. SciCheck is funded by the Stanton Foundation, which is a foundation that was created by Frank Stanton, who's a former CBS president. And in both of those cases, they have no control over what we do. In fact, Stanton came to us and said, we'd like to give you money, come up with three ideas, and we'll fund one of them. So none of they didn't come up with the idea for SciCheck, we came up with that. We do accept individual donations, but not from labor unions, not from corporations, not from anyone involved in politics. If we receive more than $999.99, we'll post their name on their website, and disclose who gives us money. And if they don't want to do that, we don't accept the check. So, and that's all on our website where it says our funding, and we have quarterly reports on where our money is coming
from. So transparency is key
to that.
So, Laura, you don't
you work for our wonderful Capital Broadcasting. There's people in our newsroom who are conservative, people in our newsroom who are liberal, and, you know, we all kind of come together at the end of the day and figure out what's in the middle. So,
but you also go for good stories, so it sounded like the Jordan Lake was just a great story.
Oh, it's a great story. Oh, there's so many. We'd be here all night. We'd be here all night. But yeah, we do love a good story, and we do love, we did an HB2 fact check too. Actually, I started working on our fact check the day the email came out, because I got 5 copies of the email from the governor's office on Saturday morning. 5 copies within an hour and a half from different agencies, all coming through state servers. And I'm like, boy, somebody really wants me to read that.
Yeah.
So, and we started looking at it, and I was like, this is ludicrous. I mean, the thing was absolutely full of misrepresentations, flat-out dishonesty, you know, left out important context, right? It was just such a mess. And so it, like, literally took 3 of us an entire day of work plus some work on the weekend to get through a fact check of that thing, because it was just such a mess. And, that's the kind of thing, when you see that come over your transom electronically, it just drives you nuts, you know?
So, Cheryl, I'm wanting to ask you this. I once was on a panel about climate change, and there was a scientist who was there, and he proceeded to say I was too dumb to ask me the question. He believed that climate change didn't exist. And he couldn't do, he's an intellectual, so he was taking apart other people's arguments, which I just couldn't do, you know? The best thing that happened in the audience, and I hope one of you out there is like this, the first person asked a question, shut up, and she was an astronaut who had been on a science mission and said, you may know, but I know, and everything you said is wrong. It helped me immensely. It could be quite embarrassing. So the deal is, though, you scientists fight like crazy about what the truth is on these things. So it sounds very nice that you want to get this debate going, but even among the scientists, sometimes they don't all agree.
Well, when it comes to climate change, there's such a strong consensus that I think it's fair to say climate change is real without making that, an argument.
Although I have heard politicians say it's
certainly
not, but I concur. The evidence is there.
The evidence is there, and there are so many layers to what you've asked me, and I promise not to take up the rest of the time. But, in science, we're not trained most of the time to be good communicators. We're trained to write in a very dry way, and we don't use these fancy things called adjectives. We're not trained in public speaking. And I can tell you that when I worked for Bill Nelson on Capitol Hill, so he's more of a conservative Democrat. He's in Florida, a really great guy. But one thing, I got there pretty idealistic. Day one, someone said to me, so is this climate change thing real? And these were some of the smartest people I had ever worked with. They just had no background or expertise in the science. Throughout my time there, many scientists would come to lobby me or talk to me on the Hill as a staffer. And either they talked down to me as if I were unintelligent and kind of turned me off. They didn't know my background. Or they would talk to me in p-values and statistics. And sometimes they'd print out PowerPoint slides, which is a terrible, terrible way to convince anyone of anything. And at the same time, I was often very much on board with whatever they were there to talk to me about, because they were from wonderful universities, institutions, organizations. But there was another side to it. And there were highly skilled communicators coming from top-notch institutions with PhDs, possibly PhDs in non-science areas, like economics, but they were making very compelling cases why, for example, climate change was a big conspiracy, and they were funny, and they would have references like Michael Crichton, and they would serve us food, and they would pack the room, and so there's been this translational challenge, and they were also very much funded by organizations that didn't want staffers to move on that issue, and as I said, there's so many pieces to this to unpack. But I think that Bill has some advice on this too. But I think that there are more and more folks who are learning to address these challenges earlier in their careers, and there's a greater interest in doing so. And so I'm very much encouraged by that, especially by the students that I work with now who want to be scientists, but also want to be in this space of science and people and policy. Phil.
So I think you hit on something that is a key reason why there has been maybe the public has been slower to understand that climate change is real. And that is, so one, I think that scientists, because they are thorough and rigorous, often are reluctant to talk in the sound bites that the media wants. And I remember covering the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and going to one of the news conferences. And it was so technical and it was so hard to get the scientists to sum up their work that it was difficult. So I think that's part of the problem. I also think that science by its very nature is about skepticism. And it's about rigor. And it's about questioning, well, do we have enough? Is this really, is this finding real? Let's replicate it. And so that process is mistakenly perceived as doubt. And so I think journalists have, particularly in covering climate change, they took too long to represent the great scientific consensus that climate change is real and that it's caused by humans. And because I think in many cases they didn't understand that the communication from the scientists represents what makes them so good, rigor. So I think you sort of, two cultures, challenges communicating, you know, it got us to where we are.
Laura, I have to add a little of that though, and I think sometimes it is because of scientists themselves, and some maybe that don't have the best motives. I'm thinking about, I don't know if any of you saw the report of ProPublica about the basically rented journals, journals that basically will publish your paper so you can call yourself a peer-reviewed published scientist without actually ever undergoing peer review of any kind.
Yep.
Right? Okay, so I mean, yeah, somebody obviously left onto a really good way to make a living because those are very popular, but I mean, it just adds to the public's misunderstanding and cynicism about science and tendency to throw his hands up in the air. And you know, whenever some of these crazy ideas, okay, the water mixers were actually the brainchild of a former EPA neurotoxicologist who was an adjunct faculty member at the Gillings School of Public Health at UNC Chapel Hill, working in the area of environmental science and engineering, right? This was his, he was concerned about the toxic effects of cyanobacteria on people. And so he developed this idea to try to agitate the water to dispel the algae from intake areas near drinking water. Okay. Whether or not that was an idea that held up, which apparently it really hasn't, his idea was that it was going to be supplementary and it was meant to improve public health, right? It wasn't meant to fix pollution, right? So part of this is he had this idea and they came up with this other idea of how to use it and said, well, look, we have scientists. This is the guy who invented it. Look, he's faculty at UNC Chapel Hill. That's good science right there. Right?
But there's also, scientists don't always say, no, the predicted. They come up with a hypothesis and then test it.
Yeah.
Sometimes it fails.
He's the vice president of the company that markets those. So he's not testing that.
I better do a commercial here. I'm just representing Warhead. I love public health. But I do think in the translational thing that you're interested in, we've created a new program. It's called 4+1. So that you come into UNC as an environmental scientist undergrad, and during 5 years, you come out with a master's degree in journalism. So it's a 5-year program, a deep knowledge, rather, and it's all because the scientists decided they weren't really effective as scientists if they didn't learn how to talk or communicate, or tell stories about what they learned. And the idea that I found good is that they didn't think they were dumbing it down. You know, our job is not to have them dumb anything down, just to be better at being able to make the public understand, because that's what we're really all about in politics, right? Having the democracy work and the public understand. But at the same time, they're not going to want to agree with you, you know, because maybe they did see it as a cheap way to fix Jordan Lake, because I bet that $1.3 million was a lot less than getting rid of the nutrients.
It was a lot less, but I mean, like, for example, another example. There was a bill going around, there's a bill that finally passed, actually, that bans the use of tanning beds by people under the age of 18. This debate went on for years, right? Every expert from every kind of hospital, skin doctor, pediatrician, came in and told them over and over again, instances of melanoma are dramatically higher among people who use tanning beds before the age of 18, 25 really, but we'll say 18. Over and over and over again, and one representative hung this whole thing up because that representative has a bachelor's degree in chemistry and is therefore the self-decided science expert, and had decided that the science on this wasn't good because she found one guy in Norway who had done a meta-study of meta-studies and had decided that somehow this was junk science, what all these many, many people were saying, and that actually held up that bill for a year. Over this. So, you know, there are this whole sort of cherry picking of somebody who takes your side. You know, whether or not it seems obvious to us, it really does slam the bricks on public policy debate. As long as you can point to one guy and say the science isn't settled, they can ignore it.
So I'm going to ask Eugene one, and then we're going to the audience. Would you be watching her stories and then coming up with a science fact to answer it? I mean, how are you picking the things that you're getting into that science fact?
Well, we do it two ways. One is by following what the candidates are saying at their various events. Also with science writer, she will also be following what is going on in the science community and in Washington, D.C. on whatever major issues that are cropping up. So for example, just the other day, the White House put out fact sheet. I love when they put out fact sheets. Because yeah, there's going to be a lot of spin in those fact sheets, if not outright falsehoods. But so I saw it was on climate change, and I sent it along to her, and I said, one of the things that we see from Democrats when it comes to climate change is to overstate the effects of climate change. It's real. It exists. It's going to lead to lots of problems, but I don't know why they will decide to cherry-pick information and put information out that exacerbates, makes it even worse than it is, to catch attention, I don't know. But this one dealt with heat deaths and the number of heat deaths that would occur because of climate change by, you know, 2060 and 2100. So, you know, we looked at the study. The fact sheet came out just one paragraph that dealt with the heat deaths, but then our science writer went into what the studies actually said, and they picked the one model that had the most heat deaths. They didn't account for a lot of the very important caveats that dealt with adjustments that would be made in the future, such as air conditioning and planting trees and whatever to do to reduce that. They didn't account for the fact that there will be a reduction in the number of deaths that are cold related. So on net, when you look at what the impact of extreme climate, extreme weather is going to be on deaths, it was not as dramatic as it was portrayed in this. And that was just one model. The other model found a significantly lower number of deaths. And this is, you know, what goes on. You know, one side will pick one piece of information that supports them, and they'll trumpet that. And the other side will pick something that is the complete opposite of that, and trumpet that out of the same study. We see that all the time.
I guess. So who wants to be the first one up asking a question? Got one back there, or we got one right up here?
I think that one is good. Before I have a feeling we're going to have good questions in this crowd. Just want to let you know there are probably some people who feed Twitter here, and we've got a hashtag going. It's SciPol, so hashtag SciPol16, SciPol. And
tell us your name.
Well, my name is Errol Zeiger. I've been a scientist for most of my life, a long time, thank you. And the trouble is there are just too many topics here to start addressing. But, you know, it's interesting, you mentioned the skepticism that science is bringing. It's just as big a problem in the law courts when it comes to scientific evidence, because they want to know yes or no, not more likely than not. But, and this is one of the, one of the horses I've been riding for the last few years, is that the public's perception of scientists, it's mostly gained from the cartoons that the kids watch, the television programs you watch. Every one of the programs that's currently on that has science in it. If the scientist is an asocial, antisocial, unsocial, somebody incapable. And if that translates to the people who are actually doing the science, and all of a sudden they become less believable or less credible because they're strange. I mean, the people who watch these programs would not come to here and they would not be able to pick out a scientist, or they would think they could pick out a scientist. They look at people with funny hair or who talk funny or who can't talk at all in complete sentences. And I don't know how to get around this problem, but I think that's a major part of the problem, is the public's perception of scientists and how connected they are with the real world.
Who wants to take that on? Our science geek here. I've already made you the geek, see?
Well, I just love that you brought that up, because that's a topic that I'm really interested in. There's a chapter in my book, Chris Mooney, on Scientific America, Hollywood and Men Scientists. And we do start by talking about how traditionally in the media, scientists are depicted as freaks, geeks, or villains. So you have Dr. Evil in Austin Powers, or you have Rick Moranis in like five different movies. And since most Americans don't know a scientist personally, more than half can't name a scientist, and among those that can, he's one of the top names when people are asked who actually do know. Does anyone want to guess who the other two might be? Okay, so the poll was done before the Hawking movie came out. Unfortunately, no. No, I'll just let you know. It's Al Gore. And Bill Gates, and this was a handful of years ago as well as done, so it might be different now. But while that's true, and I know I keep like getting up and saying a point, being like, but I'm optimistic, I do think that the culture that is changing, just in the time since Chris and I worked on that book, we've seen the Big Bang Theory as the top show on the top sitcom, and you might argue, you know, those folks are kind of, they are awkward, but you know what, every friend I have in science is awkward and quirky, and these scientists are a lot more relatable, people love them. Brady Bad, top show, that was a heavy science show. You had the National Academies launch, I believe in 2009, the Science and Entertainment Exchange, working to pair filmmakers with people in science to tell better stories. So I'm hopeful that this is representative of a broader push to tell better stories, because we really do need good storytellers with a science background to make these characters relatable and make them people we know and trust, and therefore work toward better policy and better a lot of other things.
But are they all relatable? Are they relatable?
Who wants to ask our next question? I want to make sure we get some of our back there. Stand up, tell us who you are.
Hi, my name is Megan McGrath. I'm an engineer at RTI International, right down the road. I've been writing a question. It's a little long, but hopefully it'll make sense. So we've been talking a lot about science and about politics, but you know, personally, I've been following this campaign pretty closely. I haven't seen a lot about science out there. You know, in the debates, it's not really a center of focus at all, and that kind of worries me. And I feel like a lot of the onus of that is on scientists such as myself not being able to properly communicate the important findings and things that the, you know, the citizens really need to be focusing on. So you each have, you know, experience communicating with, you know, scientists, the public, and maybe analyzing some of their thoughts. I kind of want to know what your opinions are on what scientists such as myself really need to do in order to communicate with the public and make that a focus.
So we were talking about that this afternoon on WMC, on the state of things, and I think it's great that you're placing some of that burden on yourself as a scientist. I think that burden belongs to the media. I think that the media in this particular campaign has been so caught up in other things that they have let the candidates get away with saying relatively less, at least, or relatively little about important issues, particularly scientific issues. And I think that rather than asking, hey, for the 10th time, did you retweet that picture of Ted Cruz's wife, we should be asking, so what's your policy going to be on sea level rise? Talk about your vision for the space program. And I really think the media should play a role in bringing science back to the agenda. Do you guys agree with that?
I just want to say for a couple, as disappointing as it may be in the debates that you've seen, coverage on a lot of science issues has increased dramatically over the past two elections. I can tell you in 2008, the final two candidates were asked six questions about either climate change or global warming in over 3,000 questions through interviews with most of the major correspondents. There were three unidentified flying objects for a comparison. And this time we've heard climate change, global warming, some nuclear questions, a lot more coming up. So while it's a slow change, we are seeing a definite improvement.
You do debates a lot. Do you put science in those debates when you've got the local candidates too?
We try to, if we get long enough with them. Like, for example, we have a Senate debate where we only have half an hour with four people or five people, so that makes it really difficult. And that actually brings you to the point I was going to make, which is part of the issue, too, has to do with what, at least in TV and commercial broadcasting, what broadcasters think audiences want, what they want to see, right? What they're going to be willing to watch. Science, there's a perception, and I think it's true, unfortunately, in a great deal of cases, that people either don't know about science enough to care about it, or they just don't care about it. And so why should we spend time reporting on it when we could be asking on something else, like Ted Cruz's wife's picture on Twitter? Of course, I don't agree with that because people say the same thing about politics, and yet here I am. But you know, I think it is really important, you know, to reach out to your local media, reach out to your local newspapers and TV stations and radio. Ask them to cover more science. Let them know you're interested and that there's a market for that, you know, because there's a perception that people aren't interested, so then we don't do the educational work that we should do, and then people are less interested because they know less, right? And it's a vicious circle. So, you know, please do, as scientists and as people who care about science, you know, make that ask. Let people know that you're watching and that you want to see it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I would just like to add one thing to this, which is that I think that what we've seen so far will change in the general election. Once we get two nominees, and they're going to be dramatically different, whoever they are, on the issue of science, and it will become a major issue in the campaign. Climate change will be a major issue, and it should be. Zika is going to be an issue. It's an issue now down in Washington, and it's kind of bubbling up, and it'll be part of the campaign. So these things will become a lot more prevalent once we get to the general election.
Terrific. We got somebody back there. Tell us.
I'm Scott Hewler. I'm a writer and producer here in the Triangle. Those of us who go to science writer conferences know every time you go, at one point you're going to sit down, there's going to be a seminar on the failure of the science deficit model, which is all of the researchers telling you that the problem isn't that people need more science information. That's not the problem. The problem is they don't believe it. If giving people more and better information doesn't solve the problem, what do we do?
Well, at the Annenberg Public Policy Center, one of the programs that they just started was Science of Science Communication, with the idea that they're researching this right now to find out what's the best way to communicate with the public. And this will help give the mass media the tools it needs to tell the story in a way that the public can understand it. There's a big gap between what the public knows about science and, frankly, what the media knows about science. Both of them know very little. And what they're trying to do here at the Annenberg Policy Center is try to close that gap. So there are efforts going on to address that, and I totally agree that that's a problem.
Terrific.
Anyone else want to add to that?
I was just going to add, I think some of that is going to change, I'm, to use your word optimistic, Cheryl, believe it or not, but I think as we have more and more kids coming up through STEM programs, and we're hearing more and more about the importance of STEM education in schools, I think kids are getting it earlier that science is believable, that it is a thing. The facts are things, right? You know, and I obviously that's not going to be true for every kid, but I think that's going to help because we have a whole generation of kids basically who were brought up with very little science at all, but they weren't testing for it, they weren't teaching it, right? So I mean, we have, you know, we kind of have a generation. I won't call it a lost generation, but I'll just call it an under-informed generation. And they may not want more information about science, but they certainly need it. And so, you know, I think your point about finding better ways to tell stories is a good one. And I think also making the story not about the scientist, but about the effect. Talking about not that this particular John Doe is relatable or credible or whatever, but talking about actual effects on daily life usually manages to get people's attention a little bit more quickly.
And I do want to say behind it is the science festivals, you know, that they have started, and it's not that old at Moorhead, and it's just grown. I happen to see on campus on Saturday, I mean, there were just hundreds of tents and people bringing their kids, and, you know, Moorhead used to be a place you went to, right, a museum you went to. They're trying to get it out and in the community. So I think there is something in the air, and STEM is a good reason why.
It's funny, when we have tents on campus, it's not.
No, they're just sleeping there. Right, beat us.
Can I Pollyanna this one too, just for a second, real quick?
Yep.
I think that first of all, hi Scott. Scott and I used to share a blog, so. I think that things are changing so quickly for a variety of different reasons. When I was in grad school, which wasn't so long ago, there was no viable option presented to me to do anything really other than to go toward a tenure track faculty position. I've now been consulting at so many different universities on how they can create new programs in science communication for folks traveling different paths as undergrads. On top of that, you know, we're seeing more and more people graduating with PhDs than ever, but fewer tenure track faculty jobs. So we have this army of experts out there looking for ways to apply what they know to solve so many of the problems that we're talking about here today. And so I will just stop talking now.
All right, we have a question over here.
My name is Stacy Hagwood, and I'm the director of the Urban Nature Center in downtown Raleigh. And one of the concerns that I see is that you guys are preaching to the choir. We're all very interested and very passionate about making sure that facts are a part of the discourse. Given that our country is quickly becoming more and more non-white, if we look around here, most of what we see are white faces. So then we have voters who are majority are going to be non-white. So how do we communicate science in a way that everybody is included? And I find that that's a chronic problem, is getting people of color who are not Asian involved in science so that it is looked at and respected and not a outsiders as providers on the incorporating science in the politics.
So what do you think of that? So I'm part of the science festival, part of getting the schools involved, kind of making it cool. There's also this great astrophysicist or something's on TV all the time, an African-American, I see him right up ahead. Yes, and everyone is turning to him because he's a great communicator, but B, he shows a different face. But what do you think? Have you dealt with that?
I know that there's been a push, I know, in the sciences for a long time to try to get more minority students in. And I know there are any number of great programs, including one here right in the Triangle that works specifically with minority girls, getting them to STEM. But I really think the answer to that is going to be that the sciences need to look more like the electorate before it's going to relate better to the electorate. And I wish I had the answer to that, but I don't.
I'm going to let would you stand up and tell us your name?
My
And you're the demographic we want.
My name is Lena, I'm a seventh grader, and I just wanted to ask the fact checkers, like, you put out these fact check candidates and you let the people know that the candidates are wrong, but how do you let the candidates know?
Great question, Lena. So we don't have to try very hard because they look a lot at what we do. We will often hear candidates use politifacted as a verb. So we've heard Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Chris Christie, Rick Perry have all said, I'm going to be careful here because I'm going to be politifacted. And that's wonderful to hear, because what that says to me is they are being more careful with their words because they know they're going to be fact-checked. And I think they really are finding out. We don't actively like call them up and say, we gave you a pants on fire, you know, are you going to apologize? But we do call them at the beginning of every fact-check and say, you know, hi, we're calling from PolitiFact, we're going to be checking your statement. Could you tell us the source of your information? So they know they're being fact-checked, and they care. There was an experiment done by a faculty member from Dartmouth named Brendan Nyhan, where he did a test where he warned state legislators in certain states, you're going to be fact-checked by PolitiFact. They may give you a pants on fire that could have repercussions, and then a control group didn't get those same letters. The members who got those letters were less likely to be called out for falsehoods. Now, small sample, love to see that done on a larger scale, but to me that said, they are already reading us and they care. And so it's hard, you know, but it's hard to say. It's like if there's a state trooper on the highway with a radar gun, it's hard to say how many people don't speed because they know the state trooper's there. You don't know how many people don't speed. The same way, we don't know how many lies don't get told because of fact checkers, but I know there's a lot, and it warms my heart. Mark Stenzel in the back did a great report where he interviewed political consultants who do campaigns, and they're very aware of fact checking.
So thanks for a great thing. Thanks to the collective, and back to our hosts.
We hope you've enjoyed this special edition of Radio In Vivo. Thank you to all of the participants for granting their permission to broadcast their remarks. We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website or our Facebook site for our lineup of upcoming shows. Join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM, Carrboro and Chapel Hill. If you enjoy the program, we ask that you please make an effort to support the station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. One great way to do that is to log on to the WCOM website, wcomfm.org, click on the Donate Now button, and get the details on how to make a small monthly contribution via a secure donation on PayPal to help keep this independent voice of the community on the air. Now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. We thank you for listening, and we will catch you next time.